Yes, thank you, Bucky's. Thank you, Bucky's, for sponsoring the Tom and Curly Show here on a Friday. Bucky's Auto Service Centers for nearly 50 years. They're right there. You gotta find out the birthday. Do me a favor, Andrew. You find out when Bucky's was established. I don't like having to keep saying nearly 50 years. I want to be as accurate as possible. This is Bucky's Auto Service Center. It's a great place to take your car for all your car needs. Tom Diamond, hello! Got it. I put a quarter down there on the first dive at 9 o'clock, and I was able to dive all the way down and get it. Remember that as a kid, throwing money in and then going and getting it? So much fun. All right, when was Bucky's established?
1970. It makes 48 years, I believe.
Oh, okay. Wow. Boy, it's close. It's not close enough, Tom. Okay. Sponsors in
48 it is.
That's some 48 years they've been doing it. Let's not rush them. All right. I hear a lot of radio shows constantly poking fun at the President of the United States. 63 million Americans, can't be wrong, voted for him. His popularity
rate. It's being proved every day that they can be.
Okay. Right, well, I hope you enjoy your pay raise and the fact that the economy is going for crazy. And we might even have some success with North Korea. But aside from that, there are people that listen to this show that are Trump supporters.
You bet.
Right, that voted for him and are enjoying the... largest of the fact that the government's allowing keeping more of your money. So the fact that Bill Gates had met with Donald Trump twice, once I think prior to him, he said he was at an event before Trump was elected and he avoided him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was called to the White House, I think in February, is that what it was? And I think even Donald Trump might have offered him a job. And he said, no, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, the science advisor. Bill Gates said, hey, it's really important, Mr. President, that you have a science advisor. Why? Do you want the job? And he said, I don't think that would be a good use of my time.
Yes. Okay. So he's attending a Gates Foundation sort of get-together, and somebody took some video.
Bill Gates is.
And I assume Mr. Gates knew that somebody was videotaping this.
It's hard to tell because it's certainly not a polished professional job. This is clearly, you know, the lighting is off and all that. So yeah. It seems like the kind of internal maybe recording that you might do, but I'd be surprised if there was like a big television camera making it evident. We can't tell. The Gates Foundation has not responded to the release of this information, so we can't tell this was surreptitiously released, if Bill Gates is cringing or if he's, you know, okayed it.
This can't be good.
For whom?
Well, for neither Bill Gates nor the president.
Yeah.
So when I first talked to him, it was actually kind of scary how much he knew about my daughter's appearance. But Melinda didn't like that.
Okay, so what's he accusing him
there?
We
need to explain the context.
They were in Florida, and his daughter is an equestrian.
Right.
And Donald Trump was there. I think maybe his kid or somebody he knows
or
is also involved.
Or something that he threw something good.
Yeah, the Richie Rich like to ride horses.
Right.
So you get the Richie Rich Bill Gates is there, and then Richie Rich Donald Trump is there. And Bill Gates and Trump were talking, and the president was mentioning that his daughter, Gates' daughter, had competed.
Yeah.
And Ed was talking about his daughter.
Yeah. I don't know if the Gates were there, but this is not when the conversation happened. It was later when he met him in the White House that he talked about the daughter.
He did talk to Gates at the horse event in Florida.
Okay.
Because Bill Gates also said that the president was there and then he left and then returned again in a helicopter.
That's the same event. To make a grand entrance.
That's what that's according to him, make a grand entrance.
But it made Bill Gates' wife, Melinda Gates, a little uncomfortable. And we can imagine, a lot of us are uncomfortable about the way he talks about his own daughter.
Right.
You can imagine if he's talking about somebody else's daughter. Maybe.
Okay. So then here's more. He took some shots at the president's medical knowledge and curiosity about vaccines.
Both times he wanted to know if there was a difference between HIV and HPV. So I was able to explain that those are rarely confused with each other. He asked me if vaccines weren't a bad thing because he was considering a commission to look into ill effects of vaccines. And somebody, his name is Robert Kennedy Jr., was advising him that vaccines were causing bad things. And I said, no, that's a dead end. That would be a bad thing. Don't do that.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Because we have had people on both sides of the political spectrum talk about vaccines, whether or not they're good or bad, right?
That's right. But, I mean, and that's, I mean, for Gates, Gates cut that off at the pass because Gates Foundation is very strong
big
behind
vaccines,
vaccines and dismisses the rest of it as a conspiracy. But it is a little disconcerting, although not that surprising, that the president would know the difference between HPV and HIV.
Mm-hmm. That's concerning or not concerning?
Yeah, I mean, it's disconcerting, I would say.
Both viruses, one is in the membrane that can cause genital warts, HPV, and then HIV is in the bloodstream. Both viruses. Okay, he was struck.
So therefore they're similar?
No, they're both viruses. Give him some credit, Tom. I mean, if he was playing Jeopardy and the category was HPV,
yes.
I'll take genital warts for 400, please. Okay, moving on. I mean, what would you pay for genital warts? 100. Okay, here's more from the president.
Here we go. I walked in. His first sentence kind of threw me off. He said, Trump hears that you don't like what Trump is doing. And I thought, wow, that you're Trump.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. So Trump talks about himself in the third person.
With nothing wrong with that. Alan Thicke, God rest his soul, used to do the same thing.
Is that right? Wasn't Bob Dole used to? That
Bob
was
Dole did too.
Bob
yeah.
Dole? Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. It really focuses the mind when you speak of yourself in the third person. It makes the other person have to do some serious thinking about, like, who am I talking to here? Yeah. Oh, Chubby Checker does the same thing.
Chubby Checkers?
Chubby Checkers. Used to talk about himself in the third person.
Did, okay.
I told you that story that when I went to, he was sitting in the chair.
Is that a story? No, I don't remember.
He was sitting in this. So
he's
we
the twist guy.
Right.
Right.
So we go to do lighting, and you need a certain kind of lighting if you're going to have a black guy on camera and a white guy on camera, so you're setting the lights. So we said, excuse me, sir, could you do us a favor? Would you mind sitting in the chair while we set the lighting?
Mm-hmm.
So the guy goes, yeah, Chubby won't mind that. So he sits in the chair, and he's talking and stuff. So I'm asking him questions. And I said, can we just do a quick mic check? So what do you think Chubby would say, you know, and the guy's, well, Chubby this and Chubby that and Chubby do this. And, you know, thinking about Chubby, right? So he starts answering these questions, but in depth, as if he really knows Chubby's mind. So 5 minutes into it, Daryl turns to me, leans down my cameraman and goes,
oh, no.
I think this is Chubby. Checkers. I'm like,
oh, what? You still have a job in broadcasting, Mr. Gurley?
Hold on, just a second. What? I think the reason he keeps referring to himself as Chubby Checkers.
That's funny. So was he just pulling your leg the
entire time? No, no, no. And I had no idea. And then he goes, I think Chubby's done. And I'm like, okay. And at that point, I'm thinking, are Chubby going to come in? Where's Chubby? Oh
my God. That's a wrap.
Thank you. Oh, my. That was the most confusing interview. Who's on first? Okay. All right. Let's see. Other stories to get to. As we mentioned, I think are we still going to take the break at 10:25 after? We are. Okay. And we'll have that. That's CBS with the latest in the shooting there in Houston. Most gun-owning homes in the state do not safely store firearms. This was a telephone poll that was taken. I forget how many homes that they called. And you find out that people that do have guns, I think it's a third of the population in the state of Washington
owns a gun. Yes, 34%. That's
34%.
An interesting stat.
Yeah. And when they asked, do you lock it up or is it loaded or unloaded? And the people answered, what percentage of people don't have their firearms locked away?
63% of firearm-owning households, as they put it, don't store their firearms locked and unloaded. It's interesting, again, let's do the breakdowns, and then we'll talk about the significance of this and why some people are pushing for a more stringent approach.
Mm-hmm.
34%, so you mentioned that 34% of us have a firearm in the house, a gun in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that have guns in their homes tend to be older,
mm-hmm.
white, male, retired, and married.
Mm-hmm.
Of those that have guns, only 37%, obviously the turnabout, say that they have their firearms are stored, locked, and loaded. And the people that do have them locked and unloaded, they tend to be younger, female, college graduates, and this is most important, reported having children under 18 living in the household. I think that's a good thing if that's indeed the case.
Yeah.
So out of this, what's the push behind this is, and you've got people, you know, the public health people and medical people and firearm organizations are suggesting that the problem with this is it makes suicide much easier to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that we ought to start thinking maybe about how to think of it as a suicide prevention issue more than anything else. that people have easy access to a gun will end up, it's the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and almost half of those deaths, suicide is, half of those deaths are with firearms. And they said maybe that's what access to lethal means is part of what's fueling suicides. Maybe that's the approach. It's not so much that you're going to go out and be a mass shooter, perhaps. It may be more that if there's a gun in the home, that increases the likelihood of suicide. And since suicide, they say, and the suggestion is, it's a temporary feeling. If it wasn't so easily accessible, that might not happen as often.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you, are you suspicious? You tend to be suspicious of some of these polls. What do you think of that?
Well, I got a gun, and Lay said, you can have the gun, but we got to get a safe. So we got a gun safe. Mm. I said, I don't want to cheap out and get a good one. So that's the biometric one. You put your thumb on, and the thing opens up. The gun is loaded in the safe. Put the thing on, bang, it opens up.
Okay.
So I got that because the kids were young and we want it in the safe. And then if anybody comes in, you can easily access it and shoot them. I have, from personal experience, I know about suicide and I know about guns in the home when someone is mentally ill.
Yes. Okay.
From a long time ago.
Okay.
And being very careful with the fact that when I was living somewhere else and I had a situation where I had a gun and I was conscious of the fact that it was easily accessible, so then the gun was hidden.
Okay.
Okay. But if you also look at, so 51% of suicides are gun-related, and then the next one is suffocation. Somebody strangles themselves, and then there's poisoning, and that includes toxins or at least an overdose of medicines. So I would also recommend that we lock up our pet medicine cabinets. Are you okay with that? So if somebody's suicidal and they're in the house, you think that they mentally, they're starting to question whether or not they want to continue to live, you would also then lock up medicines and you would lock up anything that would strangle them with as well.
So, okay, well, now, but what? How high a percentage? It's second, but is it like, you know, low percentage? Or if there were 50%?
51 is firearms.
Yeah. What?
25% is suffocation.
Okay, so half of it. Okay.
14% is poisoning and 8% is other.
Okay, so what, I mean, do you think, consider poisoning? I mean, you see, if we're down to under 14%, it's like 10%. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, if you're concerned about suicides, if there's a problem in your house and you can lock them up,
yeah.
I don't think that's a, you know, that's something I would do as a cautious parent if
sure.
I had a suicidal kid or a suicidal parent or
yeah, I remember when the kids spouse. Were really young and they used to get into all the cabinets and stuff. So we took and we put those lock
yes,
things
absolutely.
On the cabinet so you couldn't get down there and get
childproof. Yeah,
you couldn't get
the house
bleach or anything else that the kid may want to drink because it's a behavior that the kid may have this behavior. So then, therefore, you get harm's way.
One other thing, somewhat in reference to that, in this study, no significant differences in the mental health indicators between residents of gun-owning households and those in households without a gun.
Mm-hmm.
So that people with gun owners do not seem any more concerned about mental health and I assume the mental health connection is to a suicide. But there's no distinction between whether you have a gun in the house or not, whether mental health is a consideration. But among firearm-owning households in which safe gun storage was not practiced, alcohol misuse was more common.
Ah.
That's another problem, is you don't have to be mentally ill to, you know, misuse a gun.
Mm-hmm.
You could be, if you drink to excess, that could also be a concern.
So what would the state recommend? I know that Jenny Durkin and the Seattle City Council were going to do something about people keeping guns safely locked away. But then the state of Washington stepped in and said you can't do that when regarding all gun laws. That comes from Olympia. It can't be city-run ordinances. But what would the government do? Would they go around and check on it, or would they fine you, walk into the house and say, show me how you're storing your gun?
Okay, so the idea is what they want to do in general is to take a closer look at how you approach suicide intervention when a gun's in the household. And here's what they recommend. This could be controversial.
Uh-oh.
Recommends all states collect data inquiring about firearm ownership and storage practices via the CDC system. The practice was once standard nationally, but has not performed in many states in 14 years. So that's clinicians can also play a role by discussing firearms and safety practices with their patients. That's something I think the NRA might be objecting to. They don't think that's an invasion of privacy, and a lot of doctors see that as actually a health a prevention idea that they need to be promulgating. And finally, community-based and national campaign educating firearms about safe storage practices. Those are the three proposals.
Police in some cities across America have decided that they don't want you to be able to have access to this.
We're at 6400 North Levis.
99.
Disregard.
There are people that sit in their living rooms normally in sweatpants. Eating junk food and listening to a police scanner. Don't you think, Tom?
I think that's unfair to Andrew.
But the people do. Yes. It was a form of entertainment. They used to sell these things at Radio Shack. And you could sit there at night and listen to the police go back and forth. And occasionally people that were in the business of sort of doing sort of stringer journalism would jump in their car with the now a mobile scanner and race to the scene of a shooting or something like that.
That's exactly right. In fact, I've been in the business so long. In the last century, I used to sit at the editor's desk and we had scanners. We had like eight scanners behind us, but we also had people calling in and said who listened to scanners said, hey, did you hear the Pierce County scanner? There's something going on here. And it was actually a help to us to have another set of ears on the scanners because we have a lot of other things going on. They were very valuable, but the problem is they've become so valuable now, they're ubiquitous, not because people have more scanners. It's because now you can get a scanner app. And so everybody and his mother who has a smartphone has access to this. And so there are four or five police departments around the country that have just decided that they are going to, you can't ban scanners, but you can encrypt the scanners so that the people that don't have the encryption key, like the police officers and I'm happy to report media outlets, the general listener can't have the general citizen doesn't have access to the police information. And
do you believe why they don't want you to have it? That's hooey.
Oh, you do? Because they claim that criminals now are listening to it, and they adjust their behavior according to how the scanners indicate the police are approaching them, for instance. So they claim it's getting in the way. The problem is they're alienating they say the people that listen to scanners most are the biggest cop supporters.
Police advocates, yeah.
Yes. And so now they're kind of alienating somebody who's sort of in their corner, but they say, all in all, it's better because the criminals are cut off as well.
Yeah, I guess with the app, maybe if you really wanted to be a professional criminal, that would be something, one of the tools you would have, is to be able to know if the police are actually close to getting you or not.
Yeah.
We're going to go to CBS with the latest on the shooting in the school there right outside of Houston. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show right here on Cairo Radio. Here we go. Traffic's bad. 10:45, we'll check it for you. Plus, if any more breaking news occurs with the shooting there in Houston, we'll have that for you as well. You're listening to the Tom and Curly Show right here on Cairo Radio. Please write to us at mynorthwest.com. Text as well at 98973. Somebody gets a chance to be letter of the day. That happens at 11:47, giving you all the time so you can mark your clock and mark it in your calendar as well. And also, Tom, the know-it-all quiz is occurring. That's where we get a chance to celebrate the fact that we've covered at least five stories during the week. And we get on the phone, and Tom's lowered the bar all the way down to have a pulse.
Right.
Have a pulse, and you could win tickets to the Mariners. It was a big discussion. Of course, remember that whole Occupy thing that was going on? We are the 99%. Mm-hmm. We heard a lot from politicians talking about income inequality and how horrible income inequality is. And it's the rich guy taking from the poor guy, and the poor guy can never succeed because the rich guy has it all. And now there's a piece in The Atlantic that talks about not just the rich and the poor, not the 1% and then the 99%. There's another group in there that I think a lot of our listeners are in, the 9.9%. Who are the 9.9%?
You think a lot of our listeners are, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Well,
are they?
Okay, so the argument is, what do you mean? I'm not quite sure what your question is. Here's what's interesting about it. The top 1% had about 5% of, this is like in the 1960s or 1950s, about 5% of the wealth in this country. And it has jumped up to like 22%. This is the top 1%. And they say, however, the 99% did not lose the money to that top 1%er. It turns out the bottom 90% paid for the huge bump to the top 1%.
How?
But there is a buffer between the top 1% and the 90% that left it. And so what this focuses, and this is a 50-page article in The Atlantic. It's really too in-depth and complex for us to handle in a short segment. But the idea is that who are those, that middle, that 9.9%?
Yeah, that's what I asked. Who are our listeners? Who are they?
Well, I think that's a, our listeners, I think, do not make the kind of money that 9.9% make.
All right.
They make over like $200,000 or something and all this. So anyway, what he focuses on is the thrust is that social mobility does not exist anymore for the 90%, because whatever social mobility that used to happen, now that top 10%, the 1% is making all the money, and the 9.9% look up longingly, droolingly at the top 1% and say, "Oh, we'll never measure up." But it's that the argument is that they've created that top 10%, in effect, has created a mobility wall that makes it harder and harder for the 90% that are left to make up for that, and that he calls them the new aristocracy. That's what they are. They're aristocrats.
Yes.
They believe in their own superiority. They feel like they don't have privileges. They look up at the top 1% and say, "Well, I can't do that. I don't have 5 yachts. I only have 1." Mm-hmm. That they don't see themselves as anything other than like upper middle class at best. And he says that's stultifying our country at this point.
Let me ask you this, just to get a chance to hear from a liberal when it comes to income inequality. Are you concerned about it?
Well, yes, I am concerned about it, yes, because I do, again, this article is deep and intense.
Right. Okay.
The idea is if the top 10% make the social mobility of the lower 90% impossible or difficult, more difficult for them to shift around, uh-huh. then I think that is a problem, because we've always been sort of built on this idea that anybody can succeed in this country.
Okay, so putting aside that the 10% somehow stopped the 90% from moving, do you believe that the economy, when you say, well, the top 1% now controls 22% of the wealth, does that mean that they took it from somebody else, or did that mean the pie grew in such a way? Do you see the ever-growing pie, or do you see the economic pie as baked and set, and now we're just dividing it up into pieces?
Well, the economic pie is growing if you see it that, 20 years ago, or maybe 50 years ago, not everybody had a television, and everybody now has a television set, or they have a phone, or this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So there's progress. I'm not suggesting that when there was less inequality, that people's lives were better, just because they were just more fair. That's sort of the argument.
Right, but do you believe that if the 10% have something, do you think they took it from someone, that it's fixed? Is it fixed in that there's only a certain amount, or slicing the pie out thinner and thinner?
I mean, yes, clearly they took the percentage, because if it goes from like 5% to 22%, if in that pie it's 100% pie, then yes, then you have to take it from somewhere. And what this study says for the first time is that it's not the 1% versus the 99%. There's that actually that kind of the upper, the sort of the aristocrats, the people that hung around Louis XIV during the French Revolution days, they were doing quite well. It was the 90% below them that caused the revolution.
So let me ask you, does it upset you that somebody becomes rich? Do you believe if somebody becomes rich, that means somebody becomes poor? If we're saying we're dividing the pie up, that means that somebody grew rich, somebody grew poor as a result of the other person's richness.
Individually, I have no individual problems with this.
Okay.
The thing is, it's a societal problem if there is this bigger and bigger gap, which is what this article looks like, bigger and bigger gap, and it's harder and harder for the 90% to move anywhere.
It's not that the 10% are stopping the 90% from moving.
Yeah, well, they claim that the laws in place and the kind of issues that they put forward make it harder and harder for people to climb out of that hole.
Oh, so the law, so the government is the thing that's one of the things that's stopping them from.
Well, they say
forward.
they've learned how to pass all these advantages down to their children. Single best predictor of whether an individual will get married, stay married, pursue advanced education, live in a good neighborhood, have essential social network, experience good health. That comes out of whoever the parents are.
Right.
So whoever your parents are, that is the biggest indicator of where you're going to end up.
Yeah.
And it used to be that it was not such a big gap to get into the top 10% as it used to be. Now there's this gulf.
So the idea of you got a couple of ways to try to fix that problem. The rich do what the rich do, and the rich get rich because they keep doing what they did in the first place to get rich, and they've passed on those habits to their children. You don't necessarily, once you make the rich, you don't stay in it. Normally, most wealth, when it's inherited, is lost by the third generation. So people move up and down on the ladder.
But they
don't. Question, what's that?
Well, according to this, they don't. John, I know that's the argument you've been making for as long as we've been on the show, but they say social mobility, we have one of the lowest social mobilities in the developing world.
Can you think of any other country in the world where you can come in here with $15 in your pocket, 6 words of English in your head, and within 30 years find yourself a millionaire?
The question, John, is now that might not be the case. That's what he's saying. If that person arrived with $15 in 2018, mm-hmm. that might not be the case, whatever success story you were profiling there.
So what has changed in the last 20 years? I was talking about my buddy Joe, who came over during the Vietnam boat lift and then ended up in one of those camps in California.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now he owns a bunch of homes, and he's worked really hard, and he owns a bunch of restaurants as well, and he toils. Like I said to him one time, Joe, how many hours a day do you work? He said 18. Mm-hmm. 18 hours a day. But, you know, he now has the American dream. What other country do people put themselves on a 10-gallon jerry jug, throw themselves into shark-infested water, and hope to land on?
Okay, well, that's a myth that we've been living with.
That's not a myth, Tom. That is a reality, that people will do anything they can to come to this country.
John, a myth is not a falsehood. A myth is just the belief that this country was founded on. But according to that chart, we could I could draw up the chart, but they have all these other countries.
Tom, I saw the article. Yeah. I know. I've seen the argument before.
So United States is not the top. It's in the lower half of that mobility issue. And if we've somehow made it difficult for mobility, then that's a concern.
I like this expression that they say, whenever you see a rich person, you know he's made a lot of people happy. Jeff Bezos. I'm very happy that he delivers something in a short period of time to my house. I'm also very happy that somebody came up with a cell phone that you could buy for $50. You see a rich person that's probably became rich because he sold something to a lot of people that made their life better.
Yes, but if 90% of us can't make our life better, then we're not a good country.
90% are struggling. We'll be right back.
That's what he's saying.
I know. That's what he said, Tom. And I'm saying he's not the truth. We'll come right back, Tom and Curly, right after this. By the way, I missed the Aquaquip thing, didn't I?
We'll do it later.
Okay. Don't forget, Nisqually Red Wind Casino is the proud sponsor when it comes to Tom's movie reviews. And I'm actually going to stick around for this one because I saw Deadpool 1 and I wanted to see what you think of Deadpool 2.
Tom. All right. Well, here's a good one. Deadpool, right. the original Deadpool, I thought was
May
something
I ask
of a-
questions while you read this? No, go ahead.
Something of a breath of fresh air when it was released a couple of years ago. There he was, a Marvel character who didn't want to be a Marvel character. By 2016, we were awash in superheroes, so the world was more than ready for the smart-ass Deadpool, whose insistent mantra was, "I'm not a hero." He went about proving that by making vulgar cracks and sarcastic comments and flipping off everyone as he went about slicing and dicing all sorts of unsavory characters. Deadpool was a very R-rated superhero movie, thanks to the language and violence that he unleashed. But it was also very funny in a rude and crude and, yes, clever way. The big question for me in the sequel was whether a wisecracking Deadpool was still needed in a suddenly joke-strewn Marvel universe full of Guardians of the Galaxy and quippy Avengers, especially Thor, who's practically become a stand-up comedian in his last couple of movies. The answer, though, is a resounding yes. We may have become accustomed to our superhero movies having as many jokes as fight scenes, but Deadpool 2 still delivers a singularly raunchy and very meta sense of humor that sets it apart from all the rest. And no matter how dark or dirty the joke, it's always leavened by the charm Ryan Reynolds brings to the role of Wade Wilson slash Deadpool. Now, Deadpool movies are much more about attitude than plot, but for what it's worth, the storyline follows Deadpool's effort to protect an angry teenage mutant boy from a time-traveling mutant man named Cable, who he blames for the death of his family all in the future. Now, Deadpool decides to assemble a team of young, oddball mutants to do the job.
We're going to form a super-duper f***ing group. We need them tough, morally flexible, and young enough to carry their own franchise for 10 to 12 years.
Our group will be forward-thinking, gender-neutral. We will be known as X-Force.
Isn't that a little derivative?
You're absolutely right. Now, let's go get our f*** on.
Now, breaking the fourth wall has been a calling card of the Deadpool franchise, and it's in overdrive in this sequel, as in this first confrontation between Cable and our don't-call-me-hero.
Your time's up, dumbass.
Well, that's just lazy writing.
And so is the constant stream of pop culture references. Fox and Friends even gets a shout-out. And super in-jokes. Here's a little more with Deadpool and Cable.
You're no hero. You're just a clown. Dressed up as a toy.
So dark. You sure you're not from the DC Universe?
That's an inside joke about the DC Universe of Batman and Superman. More recent movies generally seen as dark and humorless compared to the fun and games of the Marvel Universe. Now, this meta-humor permeates the film and begins in the very opening scene with an extended and very funny riff on Deadpool's hatred for Hugh Jackman's Wolverine and doesn't end until an even funnier post-screen credit skewers Reynolds' own Green Lantern, a superhero movie that famously bombed. But that's okay. If you don't get all these jokes, it's still full of all sorts of situational humor and snappy punchlines that don't rely on a PhD in comics. All in all, this sequel is every bit as good as the original and gives me hope the trilogy finale will make Deadpool 3 for 3. Here's hoping he continues to give Bad Attitude a good name. I really like this movie.
Sounds like you liked it?
More or less, John. Thanks for not listening.
I was busy.